I'm Scott Detrow. There's so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics Podcast. With a team of NPR political reporters and editors, we record 2 episodes a week and sometimes more when the big news happens. Find the NPR Politics Podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so...
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
Hey, Maria.
Hey, Zakia.
So, I know you're not a sports fan.
Yes, I know nothing about sports. Very, very little.
I'm wondering, have you heard anything about this?
The Linsanity continues. The Jeremy Lin phenomenon that has swept the nation.
Is any of that familiar to you? So this is a safe space. You can say okay.
I think it's Jeremy Lin. He plays basketball.
Yes.
I don't know what team he plays for.
Yeah, so he's on the Nets now. But back in 2012, when he was on the New York Knicks, he was a phenomenon. Basically, he just came out of nowhere and started making tons of dramatic game-winning shots and became the biggest Asian-American basketball star in the league. But he's not just famous for Linsanity. Over the last few years, he's gotten pretty famous for something else.
Here is Lin. You'll have no trouble noticing him with the hairdo.
He looks like a comic book character.
Looks like he stuck his finger in an electrical socket.
What?
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to show you a picture of what he looks like now.
Oh. So he's got dreadlocks, and he's got them pulled back into kind of a high ponytail. And it's shaved on either side. To me, I'm like, it looks okay, but I guess I might be sticking my foot into a major controversy right now. I'm getting that feeling.
And, you know, that's part of it. Like, some people are like, oh, he looks good, right on. And other people are like, no. Dreadlocks have a really politicized history. Dreads first got popular in the U.S. in the 70s when Bob Marley came on the scene. They were this Rastafarian religious symbol, and a lot of Black people started wearing dreads to connect with their African roots. But Black people have gotten a lot of pushback, too. You know, as recently as 2016, courts defended the rights of a company who refused to hire someone just because they were wearing dreads.
And it's just a hairstyle.
Yeah, but it's more than that. And Jeremy Lin gets that, too. So he wrote an article all about it for the Players Tribune. He heard people's concerns, and he actually understood it. And he even wrote, quote, "I know what it feels like when people get my culture wrong. I know how much it bothers me when Hollywood relegates Asian people to token sidekicks."
So if he's such a thoughtful guy, you know, thinking about his hair a lot, obviously, why dreads?
He likes to use his hair as like a, you know, form of self-expression to push himself out of his comfort zone. And he was out one time and he saw this Taiwanese man with dreadlocks. And he was like, oh, that looks pretty cool. And then he's talking with his Black teammates, and they and some other staff members encouraged him to go for it. And they're like, you know, as long as you understand the significance of the dreads and the history. So he decided to do it. But he's still not sure if it was the right call in the end.
So I had an interesting reaction, but what about other people? Were they like, yeah, thumbs up, it looks good? Or were they like, how dare you?
Well...
All right, bro, we get it. We get it. Like, you want to be Black, but the last name is Lin. All right?
Whoa.
Yeah. So that is Kenyon Martin. He is a former basketball player. He's African-American, and he took to Instagram. But Jeremy Lin tweeted, quote, "I appreciate that I have dreads and that you have Chinese tattoos."
Oh, my God. Whoa. So this is like, you know, the cultural appropriation war.
You have two people of color, you know, appropriating each other's cultures. One is saying, hey, this is a form of appreciation. And the other one's like, hey, you're taking my culture. You know, Kenyon Martin ended up apologizing. And even Jeremy Lin knows that there's no easy answer to this.
Getting dreadlocks is not as simple as just getting dreadlocks. Like, what I've been learning and reading is there's actually a lot of people who have received some type of discrimination because of that. And so being aware of these issues brings us to a better place where we further understand each other. Maybe something that's missing right now.
He's grappling with it in real time. And the takeaway from his article is like, you know what? This is such a contentious thing. Let's have an open dialogue about it.
And that's exactly what we're going to do on today's show. We're going to have an open dialogue on the ins and outs of cultural appropriation, which is, of course, a great Halloween tradition. And you've probably seen it yourself when you've seen somebody who is not Latino wearing a sombrero or in Day of the Dead calavera makeup during this time of the year. Now, cultural appropriation, basically, is when an individual from one culture adopts elements from another culture. I mean, this could be clothes, it could be food, it could be language, etc., etc. But today, we're not going to focus on white people and cultural appropriation, but rather the confusing and murky world of POC on POC appropriation. For example, Latino rappers who use the N-word, or an Asian American woman who's accused of appropriating from her own culture. Plus, we're going to imagine a future in which cultural appropriation is policed not just on Twitter, but by the government. But first, Sakia, you actually sat down and you had exactly the kind of conversation that Jeremy Lin was talking about. So what happened?
So, you know, Maria, this is something that I've been thinking about for years. So I decided to get a few people together and have a conversation about it. So I talked to Brianna Gray, a writer and the host of the podcast Someone's Wrong on the Internet, John McWhorter, a professor of linguistics at Columbia and host of Slate's podcast Lexicon Valley, and multimedia journalist Walter Thompson Hernandez. Now, I started off talking with just Brianna and John, but you'll be hearing from Walter as well in a little bit. So in October of 2015, Yale University sent out a letter to its students cautioning them against wearing culturally insensitive Halloween costumes, you know, ones that could offend students of color. Yale lecturer Erica Christakis pushed back and sent out a campus-wide response. She defended students' rights to wear what they want, even if it is offensive. So the question is, how do you negotiate one person's right to wear what they want, but on the other hand, be sensitive to not offending people? Brianna, let's start with you. What do you think?
The issue with Erica's email is that it pretended as though the initial email warning students that, hey, you might offend your peers if you wear certain kinds of costumes was forbidding student behavior, or students were going to be sanctioned or expelled. Since that wasn't the case, Erica's email came off as defending something that didn't need defending.
That's very true. But I think what struck many people was why anybody would be that viciously angry at something like what Erica Christakis wrote. And I think that many people are perplexed that any grown-up would be cursed at, or that Erica Christakis would essentially be hounded out of her job.
I have a little bit more empathy for the passion behind the response. The fact that she wrote it seemingly as though we were living in a vacuum, in which the idea that students at a prestigious university don't routinely dress up in a way that caricatures the identities of their peers, and that doesn't have like real psychic effect, and that doesn't reflect a greater sense of being marginalized on a historically white campus like Yale's. I think that's where the venom came from.
You know, I would push back a little bit, because I think that sometimes the way this is discussed makes it sound as if to be a student of color on a modern college campus is to, on Halloween, watch people regularly walking around blacked up. These things aren't as cut and dried as, say, people at a sit-in in 1962, where if anybody walked up to them and said, you know, there are other ways of looking at this, must you sit there and insist on your hamburger? I think we would all say, no, the issue was rather clear.
So I think that most in this panel who've, you know, been on a college campus in the last, you know, 10 years or so, have seen, if not someone blacked up during Halloween, someone wearing some kind of Mexican costume with a giant hat and a mustache. That is disrespectful in a way that is pretty easy to understand. A letter that says, be sensitive to this kind of thing, I think that that's appropriate.
So talking about appropriating fashion and style, I wanted to get y'all's thoughts on, you know, what went down between Jeremy Lin and Kenyon Martin. And just so that we're all on the same page, Lin is a Chinese-American basketball player who got dreads. And then Kenyon Martin, who's a black player, accused him of cultural appropriation. And then Jeremy Lin clapped back and said that Martin is actually covered in tattoos of Chinese characters.
I think that that was a sick burn on the part of Jeremy Lin. And I think that the point here is an exchange is a two-way street. if there are two ethnic minorities involved, then what is the relationship between those two groups? Is there a historical relationship where there is an imbalance of power, which makes us question whether or not locks are being, privileged because they're being used by Jeremy Lin as opposed to a Black person, or Chinese characters being privileged because they're being worn by a Black person instead of by an Asian person. So with respect to Jeremy Lin, you know, I don't have the same kind of visceral reaction that I might if a white person did it. And I also think what it's about is whether or not it frustrates people because it reflects a sense in which greater society, things which are Black, aren't valued until they're adopted by non-Black people.
But I think that the issue of appreciation is important because it seems to me that we're asking that somebody like Jeremy Lin, he can appreciate them by saying, boy, those look nice, but he better not wear them. And Jeremy asks, well, why? And you say, well, because if you wear them, it's going to stand out in a way that it wouldn't if a Black person wore them. And therefore, that means that you're profiting because people are looking at you. And also, you're erasing the Black person. And do you notice how it seems like we've come up with this way of talking about this that I'm not sure would necessarily make sense to somebody who was brought in from the outside? I think I understand what people are meaning, but to be honest, I worry about pride. It seems to me that if you think that somebody imitating you threatens to erase you, doesn't that suggest that you kind of thought you didn't exist?
So, John, my pushback is you behave as though there hasn't been a long history of Black accomplishment and Black innovation being erased and subsumed into a broader white identity. That erasure feeds into this idea culture started recently and that there's not this long, you know, centuries and centuries of histories in which math and science and musical instruments and pasta and paisley, all of these came from brown cultures. And it enables people to persist in and perpetuate a kind of a white supremacy. And so when we fight these smaller battles about locks, it's not about what an individual can and cannot do. Nobody is prohibiting anybody from doing anything. No one's going to be lynched in the street for being a white guy with dreadlocks. But to have these conversations and let white people or people like Jeremy Lin be aware of the fact that there is a risk that they might be perpetuating a kind of erasure that other people might find problematic, I think is healthy.
Coming up on Latino USA, we get into our problematic faves and talk about Latino rappers using the N-word.
You know, the word is often, it gets murky because you're like, yeah, you are ethnically Latino, but racially you're Black, right?
Stay with us. No te vayas.
Latino USA is part of an independent nonprofit media organization, and we're proud to bring you narrative journalism representing the new American mainstream. We love hearing from our listeners, like Mariana Mariana, who wrote on Facebook, "Latino USA is my favorite podcast. It is so refreshing to consume news from the standpoint of those who look like us, sound like us, and care about the same issues." Thank you, Mariana. If you also love our work, please support us and donate today. Go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button. And please, consider making it a monthly gift. Every dollar you give us goes towards our award-winning journalism.
Thanks for listening to Latino USA. Please tell us what you like about the show and how we can improve by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/LatinoUSA survey. It takes less than 10 minutes, and you do all of us at Latino USA a huge favor by filling it out. Again, it's npr.org/LatinoUSA survey, all one word. Thank you. Mira, mi amor. Mira, mi amor. Mira, mi amor.
Pienso cuanto más pienso, yo me pregunto, mi amor, ¿cuál es la forma que tengo? ¿Qué tengo yo ante tus ojos? Pienso cuanto más pienso.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today we're digging into the topic of cultural appropriation. And when we left off, we were hearing a discussion on cultural appropriation and how things get especially confusing when people of color appropriate from each other. Our producer, Zakiya Givens, was having a conversation with Brianna Gray, who's a writer and the host of the podcast Someone's Wrong on the Internet, and John McWhorter, who's a professor of linguistics at Columbia University. And coming up, we're also going to hear from multimedia journalist Walter Thompson Hernandez. Let's dive back into that conversation right now.
All right, so we've been touching on it, but let's talk specifically about cultural appropriation between communities of color. So how does this work? How do we approach something like this?
Well, it seems to me that we have to make sure to distinguish between exchange from above and exchange from below, because I think many people hear that question and they say, is there something wrong with the fact that Latino people or Black people now do this thing that white people did? And a standard answer, and I think I understand it, is that, well, that was oppressed people taking something from the oppressors. And so some people might have the radical position that there shouldn't have been cultural exchange over the past several millennia. But I think most of us would say, for example, that we're glad that there's jazz and there's rock and roll. And that, frankly, is white people stealing, as we would say today, from Black people. And then Black people taking it up and making it better. And so if we can't have white people wearing dreadlocks today, then we can't have jazz and we can't have rock and roll. I'm not sure how many people would say that those things shouldn't have happened.
Yeah, I think this is a really fascinating question because it comes up a lot in my life. I'm going to a wedding of an Indian friend in India, and we're all supposed to go sari shopping. And I've been thinking about, well, now I'm out here on the internet as this, you know, somebody knowledgeable about cultural appropriation. What's it going to look like when I turn up on Facebook and all these pictures of a sari, you know? And again, you have to examine what the kind of relationship is between the two people of color and see if whether or not what you're doing is at all exploitative or disrespectful. And I think, you know, I've come to terms with, if I'm going to a wedding of a long-term friend in a country where everybody's wearing this and this is just showing respect to blend in and adhere to custom, well, that's one thing. If I were to take the expensive, nice dress that I buy for this wedding and then wear it for Halloween next year, that would be problematic. The idea that culture and race are coterminous is part of the problem. Right. So there are things that are seen to be a part of Black culture that I, as a Black person, might not have particularly affinity for, and which my boyfriend, who's Chinese American, who was raised in a predominantly Black and Latino environment in the Bronx, might actually have an affinity for. And it's an ongoing question for me how much one's personal exposure, you know, if you're an Eminem who grew up in a certain environment, do you have more entitlement to that culture, regardless of being white?
We're going to have a problem here. Then
someone who grew up in an upper middle class environment, like myself, who grew up overseas, has to that same, you know, quote unquote culture, because it's also really entwined with class.
Yeah. So I actually want to get into some of the language stuff that you brought up, Brianna. And I want to specifically talk about Latino rappers and the N-word. You know, it's like pretty commonly held, like if you're not Black, you can't say it. But and then there's some people who are like, well, there's some exceptions, like Fat Joe, he can say it, but Jennifer Lopez, she can't. So for this part of the conversation, I want to bring in Walter Thompson Hernandez, who actually wrote an article on this exact topic.
Yeah. So I watched this interview with Cardi B, right, who was interviewed by a DJ named DJ Vlad, who has his own like YouTube channel called DJ Vlad TV. And he kind of, you know, asked Cardi B, he was like, well, you know, how do you feel about Latinos and the N-word, you know?
And Cardi B is Dominican.
And I think her mother's from Trinidad, right? I write about how Big Pun, you know, rest in peace, and like Fat Joe use the N-word and like have been sort of questioned about it, right?
Fat Joe is Puerto Rican and Cuban.
And Big Pun is Puerto Rican, exactly. I kind of like preface all that by saying that, you know, I grew up in like a very sort of Black and brown environment in South LA and throughout Los Angeles, where both non-Black Latinos, particularly Mexicans and Central Americans, were using the N-word around black folks. And there was this sort of like a fluid way that we all kind of used the word, right? But then you also have Latinos who are Afro-Latinos, right? Who are Latinos of African descent, who are often racialized in the U.S. as black Americans. So, you know, the word is often, it gets murky because you're like, yeah, you are ethnically Latino, but racially you're black, right? It's very complicated, and it's a debate and a dialogue that I think will not be ending soon.
So some people are like, it's not appropriation if you've lived that experience. Mm-hmm. So if they have, but they're not black, does that give them license to use the N-word?
Okay, you have folks in the academy who are academics and who are in popular culture who feel a certain way about it, but there are people in the hood who don't have access to that information and to that knowledge and to that lexicon, right? So they have a different experience, a very sort of real experience where, you know, they're being, you know, harassed on the police by cops and being mm-hmm. killed by police. And so black and brown folks often feel a solidarity there. And so the word often connects people more than it doesn't.
But what if you have someone who is black, but like grew up wealthy and in Vermont and has a completely different life experience? Do they have as much of a right to say it or less? And does life experience count for more than racial identity?
Part of it is, for me, has always been, can this hurt you as much as it hurts me? I'm not ever going to be as offended if a black person says the N-word as a non-black person, just point blank, period. However, I do think race and class are seen to be overlapping, and they're not. And there's a way that we talk about black people in America that assumes a certain kind of class-based cultural background that is not necessarily true to all black people. And I know that as someone who like grew up abroad and like missed the entire 90s and came to college with like an embarrassingly, you know, low amount of like hip hop knowledge, that, you know, it feels wrong to me to use certain kinds of jargon and to like appropriate, you know, certain kinds of lingo or pretend to be something that I'm not. And in the same way that it's, you know, classist and inappropriate for, you know, all these middle class, upper middle class, wealthy white people to be talking about white trash yokels all the time and affecting a country twang.
John?
I think that the word has become a lot more complicated than it used to be. I think another way of looking at it is that this rich black person from Vermont, there are very few people who actually fit that description, but that, that person would be considered to be able to use it however they wanted to, because it's generally said that there are certain experiences that a person black has no matter what. But I find particularly interesting the fact that the word has come to mean buddy, and it's been used that way by black people really forever. It's not something that just started with rap music. This is something that goes back to the 19th century at least. And then what happened is that, first of all, many Latinos started using it in the same way because they felt that there was a large overlap between their culture and black culture. And then because there's a browning of the culture that has particularly happened since about 1995, a lot of, you know, even white people, men in particular, feel comfortable using that word to mean buddy because they feel that there's something of a black person inside of them. And all that's very complicated. And I still feel strange when I see especially white boys doing that. But, you know, to tell you the truth, we can have this discussion, but I'm not sure we can control how they use the N-word.
So one of the things that I absolutely love millennials, and I love the fact that millennials are so hypercritical of everything. I think it is a manifestation of a certain amount of privilege, right, to be able to dissect everything. Because I'm thinking about, like, when I was experiencing cultural appropriation, it was like eye roll after eye roll after eye roll. But it was never there was never a conversation about it. It just was like an invisible conversation. So I'm like, you know what? I'm just really happy that people are talking about it, because this stuff is really complicated. It's multi-leveled. And I'm hesitant to be the one that says, I'm the decider. This is good. This is bad. Because that's challenging, too.
And also you have to think, like, how productive is it to be like, this is good. This is bad. And I feel like that's part of the reason why we keep having the same conversation over and over again, like why people keep wearing these costumes over and over again. And in my research, I was talking to this one professor, Professor Pham, and she was saying that a problem with this whole issue of cultural appropriation is how we talk about it. And sometimes we just It's just the word has grown into something that's too much of a catch-all. And so we're not even really pinpointing what the issue is. She was like, is that cultural appropriation or is it just racism or is it appreciation? You know, and I think that people don't understand the nuances that comes with cultural appropriation. It's not just good or bad, but like Brianna pointed out, what's this, the historical relationship of these two groups? You know, what are the power differentials? Is this cultural exchange and not appropriation? And, you know, Professor McWhorter, John McWhorter was saying that, you know, we're getting into this territory of a take no prisoners response. And, you know, I agree with you, Maria, that like sometimes it's, I think we need to get away from don't do that, this is bad. We actually need to have a dialogue and open up about like the intricacies of this hot button issue.
Zakiya, thanks for that roundtable.
No problem. So, you know, Maria, we had that roundtable where we kind of got into the like social cultural rules of appropriation, cultural appropriation. But now we want to kind of get into the hard facts of it. Like, where did the concept of cultural appropriation even come from?
Where did it come from?
The idea of this inappropriate taking, right, has been around for a long time, whether we call it imperialism or simply theft, right? It's been there.
That is Susan Scafidi. She came to our studio a little while ago, and she is a preeminent expert on cultural appropriation. She even wrote a book called Who Owns Culture, Appropriation and Authenticity in American Law. So she is like the expert on all things cultural appropriation.
I didn't know one existed, but cool.
Neither did I. And then she came through and was super helpful. She told me that cultural appropriation has only been an issue in countries with a colonial history.
Oh.
Because we have this sense that when there is imperialist action, we have one group coming in, taking the land, taking the people, taking personal property. Oh, and by the way, taking the intellectual property as well, sort of adding insult to injury.
So back in the day, the way we referred to it, and I'm not even sure if it was a kind of academic term or not, but we just called it cultural imperialism. Yeah, this is like 80s, you know, 80s when I was in college mostly.
Yeah, you know, and if it wasn't even being used in the 80s, the term cultural appropriation was definitely not a thing in the colonial era. But, you know, that doesn't mean that it hasn't been happening since the inception of this country. There are just way too many instances of cultural appropriation throughout U.S. history for us to name them all, from white communities taking on jazz culture in the 20s to the 40s, to white rock and rollers in the 70s personifying black musicians. To white actors like Seth Green in the late 90s, early 2000s, playing wannabe rappers.
You know what that means, don't you? Huh. That means I got some 92% chance embarrassing myself.
So, you know, even though we have all of these clear examples, it wasn't actually called cultural appropriation until very recently. So Susan, who wrote that book, she told me that when she was publishing her book back in 2005, she actually got a lot of pushback from her editor about using the term cultural appropriation because the editor thought that no one would know what that term meant.
I had to explain what it meant over and over.
Then something happened that helped make the conversation about cultural appropriation way bigger than ever before.
The recent dramatic rise in attention to cultural appropriation really has to do with the internet.
I was going to say Facebook.
Yeah, well, no, but you're even closer. You know, the internet, social media, you know, YouTube was created in 2005. This is where you can start to kind of peer into the windows of other people, not to sound like a creeper, but you really could see how other people were talking or dressing and looking and living.
Hi, guys. Thank you guys for coming back. Today's video is the last video.
Not only did way more people become acquainted with the term and the concept, but the way people talked about it just fundamentally changed.
Suddenly, we have groups of people able to see what other groups of people are doing, first of all, so there's this transparency, and aggregate their voices to complain if they find it inappropriate. We never had that kind of communication before. Over time, over the past really 5 to 7 years, cultural appropriation has trended as a term to usually mean something negative.
Before the internet, the only people who were able to comment about culture and have their ideas out there were academics or hoity-toity cultural critics from The New Yorker and whatnot. But nowadays, anyone can write a think piece, and therefore anyone can, you know, be a cultural critic. More often than not, those think pieces are often critical. And by the same token, anyone can put their ideas out there for the world to see and have their ideas stolen.
Oh, it's recording. Hey, y'all. I know I have.
Have you heard of the phrase, eyebrows on fleek?
Nope.
So you've never heard of eyebrows on fleek?
No, seriously, but I do work on my eyebrows, but I had never heard about that one. Okay, no.
Okay, so it's a phrase coined by Peaches Monroe. Her real name is Kayla Newman. She was an internet personality. She liked to, you know, make videos of herself, post them online. It was a cute little thing. And then she had this one video where she's in the car. She's has the forward-facing camera, and she's looking at herself, and she's just feeling herself. She's like,
eyebrows on fleek.
That term, eyebrows on fleek, just like took off and spread like wildfire. And it went viral, and specifically on Black Vine and Black Twitter, you know, just like the Black online community. Then you have people like Ariana Grande saying it.
When I get crunk, eyebrows on fleek.
Even IHOP was using the term on fleek. They tweeted out pancakes on fleek.
Oh my God, I feel so stupid.
No, you shouldn't. You shouldn't. You know, I feel like IHOP should feel stupid because it's like, what are you using this term, you know? And that's kind of like the problem, because IHOP used this term for advertising to bring in more people and to seem culturally relevant. But Peaches Monroe didn't see any of that money. Cultural exchange is happening so fast today that the legal framework hasn't been able to keep up. So that begs the question, do we need a legal framework to protect people like Peaches Monroe who are sharing culture at lightning speed?
One action can have economic harm to a community. It can have psychological harm to a community. And it might even be legally actionable, although legally actionable, as we've said, is still quite rare.
Coming up on Latino USA, how does our legal system deal with cultural appropriation? And how might it tackle it in the future?
There can be approval from a particular group of a particular product, or approval can be withheld from something that is not authentic.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
Is there room for me in Los Angeles? It's a question a lot of Latino residents are asking themselves as the city gentrifies. But does development have to mean displacement? I'm Saul Gonzalez, host of our new podcast series, There Goes the Neighborhood LA, from KCRW and WNYC Studios. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Guardar el papel con su nombre y el frasco con miel. Así como está miel. Es dulce, así será para mí.
Quizá tú tengas guardada algún tipo de poción. Y esa sea la explicación. Me atrapaste y yo aún no encuentro la razón. Esto parece ficción. Dime si tú le encuentras sentido. Es muy bueno y corrosivo. Te volviste todo por lo que me des.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm María Hinojosa, and with me in the studio is Zakiya Gibbons. All right, so Zakiya, you and I were having this conversation. You were, in fact, giving me this quick history lesson on how we think and talk about cultural appropriation in the United States.
Yeah, that's right. So we were just talking about a few examples of what Susan Scafidi calls not just cultural appropriation, but cultural misappropriation. So you might be thinking that all instances of cultural appropriation would be misappropriation. You know, if you do or say or take anything from another cultural group, then that's some kind of inappropriate taking. But back in the day, before the term was so widely used, it was essentially a neutral and descriptive umbrella term that could mean both a positive form of appreciation, like learning to speak another language, and it could also be an inappropriate misappropriation, like a non-Native person wearing a Native headdress as a costume. So from a legal standpoint, cultural misappropriation is used to describe instances when someone takes from another culture for financial gain. So then I started to wonder, are there any legal consequences for cultural misappropriation, and should there be any? This is something that Susan has thought about a lot. I asked her about the laws around cultural appropriation, and she started out by talking about the main way that people and companies make lots and lots of money today, and that's by owning intellectual property.
In our legal system, intellectual property law acknowledges individual creators, the individual genius or inventor in the garage, the great American author, much more easily than it does any kind of collective creativity.
So, in other words, take the guy who invented the Coca-Cola recipe. It was invented by one person in one place and at one time. His invention is protected by the law. He can profit off of it.
But when it gets to ideas or manifestations of culture, it can be a little bit more difficult, I'm assuming.
Yeah, exactly. So it's much harder to figure out authorship when something is created collectively, like, say, a traditional indigenous melody or a recipe passed down through generations. And so that's what makes those kinds of things easier to steal.
So right now, are there laws on the books that essentially prevent this?
Kind of.
So in the U.S., the specific law pertaining to cultural appropriation really only involves Native Americans.
So there's only one super specific law that prevents tribal names from being used in marketing, but not the culture in general.
And it involves either using the term Indian or Native American or a tribal name to describe a handicraft or something similar.
So back in 2011, there was this incident with Urban Outfitters. They came out.
Ooh, Urban Outfitters.
So back in 2011, Urban Outfitters, they came out with this line called the Navajo line. So they had like a flask with like a quote unquote Navajo print. They
had a
quote unquote Navajo panty. And they had, you know, shirts with like headdresses. And they just had the word Navajo all over all of it. And they're like, this is so cute, our Navajo line.
Uh-oh.
The Navajo Nation sued Urban Outfitters, and they won because the name Navajo was used in the products.
Had Urban Outfitters simply used the same patterns and just called them Southwestern, the Navajo Nation would have had no cause of action whatsoever.
And so Susan says that in general, it's hard to stop cultural misappropriation from happening. And this happens in all sorts of industries, but especially in music.
There was a song by Enigma. The German group in the 90s called Return to Innocence.
That's James Anaya. He's a lawyer who focuses on indigenous rights. And this classic song ended up being controversial because
the central melody of it was taken from the Amish people.
They're an indigenous group from Taiwan.
And the record company made a lot of money off that, but the Amish gained nothing from it. It was just literally taken from them.
So there was eventually a lawsuit related to the song. The Amish man singing the song sued the band's producer and a few recording companies, and they settled out of court. But this kind of theft has happened over and over and over again.
And you know what else? I'm sure that this happened to a lot of people, right? Which is that you kind of love something, like maybe that song, right? And then you realize, like, oh, bad. I need to be more aware of this.
Problematic faves. Yeah.
Problematic faves. There you go.
So that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about cultural sharing. We're talking about illegitimate taking and profiteering off indigenous people's culture and protections for that.
James Anaya works with a group of indigenous activists from all over the world, and they've been trying to make cultural misappropriation illegal under international law. And there's been tons and tons of meetings and hearings for over 16 years, and it probably won't become law anytime soon. And that's about it when it comes to the law and cultural appropriation. But Susan Scafidi does have an idea of what could be done. And I thought it was pretty interesting.
My own suggestion for creating some kind of protective system comes back to this question of being able to label things as authentic. We could use our current trademark system in the U.S. to do something very similar. We have things that are called collective marks and certification marks.
Okay, so for example, USDA organic or fair trade, kind of stamps of approval that can be put on products.
There can be approval from a particular group of a particular product, or approval can be withheld from something that is not authentic.
So in Susan's world, if you bought a shirt with the Navajo print or something like that, that print could have a stamp of authenticity. And so when you buy that shirt, the profits of that go to that Navajo person or community instead of some big faceless corporation or someone who isn't even connected to the culture at all. And, you know, you could do this for music, food, or for anything.
Did you consider buying that from someone who had inherited the recipe from their great-great-grandmother, right? Is that possible for you? If so, then it's kind of nice to make sure that the source community is profiting economically.
So, Maria, what do you think about this idea? Like, if you were in a store and you were about to buy something and you see that thing has a label that says authentic, would you be more likely to buy it?
I'm intrigued by that, but I still, the thing that makes me uncomfortable is the whole notion of who gets to decide. And, you know, it can't just be one person, right?
Yeah, I see that. And I did ask Susan about this, you know, if she was worried at all that making laws about cultural appropriation could backfire in some way. And she said, yeah, you know, there is that argument.
Culture is fluid, and fencing off culture into areas of ownership will stop that fluidity and stop the evolution of human culture. We'll all just retreat to our own cultures, and the benefits of cultural exchange could be lost. Right? That's the scary part.
I think what's really important now in this moment in history is that because the demographic changes are occurring, that people of color, people whose culture has been appropriated, now have a voice in that conversation. And that's where I find it interesting, where it can't just happen and we have to be quiet. It's going to happen, but you can expect a dialogue, a conversation, and not the way it was when I was growing up. Power has changed.
You know, you're right. Yeah, power has changed. So, you know, whenever anyone does something offensive, it'll go online and people will be aware of it, and then that'll affect their business. So, yeah, there might not be legal consequences now, but there are definitely social consequences.
Latino USA producer Zakiya Gibbons. Now, on this entire episode, we've been circling the topic of cultural appropriation, and we've been talking about some hypothetical situations. But to close our show, we're going to come right down and zoom into one woman's personal experience. Gina May is half white and half Chinese, and she was raised by a single mom from Hong Kong. Gina was super proud always of her identity, but one day, something happened that shifted the way she carried herself forever. Here's Gina.
As a kid, I never had to question whether I was Chinese. I was raised by a single mother, a badass immigrant woman from Hong Kong who made sure I knew who I was and where I came from, teaching me to write my Chinese name before my English one. My father, a white dude from Ohio, was never around to tell me otherwise. On Chinese New Year, I'd call relatives halfway around the world, Gong Hei Fa Choi, Lai Si Dao Loi, essentially wishing them a happy and healthy new year before cheekily asking them for red packets filled with money. I'd count the crisp 10s and 20s fresh from the bank before stuffing them in a denim Hello Kitty wallet I hid under my bed. After my Gong Gong and Paw Paw passed, I was taught to light incense for them, to bow three times before a small altar overflowing with oranges and kumquats. By high school, I was passively fluent in Mandarin. But despite this, for all the so-called proof I had of my Chineseness, I was beginning to understand that I was different. That to strangers and even to my own family, I was somehow not Chinese enough. I have never been white passing or Asian passing, and growing up in Los Angeles, most people have always assumed I'm Latina. I've been scolded countless times for not being able to speak Spanish. A fair number of people seem to think I'm making a not that funny joke when I say I'm half Chinese, because apparently it's that unbelievable. At first, this was just frustrating. Constantly having to explain what you are to people gets tedious, especially when it's the only terrible pickup line you've ever heard in your entire life. But it also felt personal, like a constant reminder that there was something wrong with me. Scarier than that, it genuinely felt like people were pissed when I gave them an answer they didn't like, as if my not fitting into their ideas of what a Chinese person should look like was a personal affront. Sidelong glances when I spoke Mandarin or wore a camp t-shirt emblazoned with Chinese characters became more common than not. My family calling me a guaimuizai, which essentially translates to little foreign devil girl, didn't feel quite as affectionate as before. And then, when I was 16, it happened. Aesthetically, there are few things that feel as representative of Chinese culture than the cheongsam, a traditional garment that dates back to the Qing dynasty, although some argue that its roots extend back even further. The cheongsam today is more a nod to tradition than an everyday outfit. So 16-year-old me was volunteering at a high school luncheon for the Chinese Parents Association for Chinese New Year. I was setting up one of the food tables wearing my favorite cheongsam, a sheer black dress covered in colorful embroidery layered over a simple black slip. It had been my mother's, one of the only ones that fit me. It made me feel powerful and beautiful and proud. And then a girl from the grade below me, who I'd never spoken to before, walked up to me and said, "What's a Mexican girl like you doing appropriating my culture on Chinese New Year?" My heart sank. Not only did a fellow Chinese person not believe that I was Chinese, but she was so sure in this belief that she felt self-righteous enough to call me out over it. I immediately wanted to vomit. I explained to her that I was biracial, that my mom had immigrated to the U.S. in the 1970s. In response, she told me, "There's no way you're Chinese because you don't look it at all." I tried to explain that I was half Chinese and half mostly Italian. Before stomping away, she told me, "Either you're adopted or someone's been lying to you because you're definitely not Chinese." I feigned outrage, but the truth is, I was totally shaken. Like, I was being dirty and insensitive. Maybe I really wasn't allowed to wear a cheongsam, even if my mother had given it to me, and even if I saw myself as Chinese. If I'd had a change of clothing with me, I'd have ripped the dress off right there and then. When you're told multiple times that you aren't enough, to pass or otherwise, you start to believe it. My former classmate was simply the breaking point, and her words only confirmed something that I had already suspected, that I'll never be Chinese enough. Not to her, not to my family, not to the world. Because of something I can't help, aka my face, I will never be allowed to take part in my own culture without someone assuming that I'm appropriating it. When I got home, I took the dress off, put it on its hanger, and subconsciously knew I'd never wear it again. Logically, I know that I wasn't being insensitive all those years ago, that I wasn't being culturally appropriative. I've been wearing cheongsam since before I could walk. And even if that weren't true, I'd still be Chinese. But I also know that doesn't matter. If the world treats me like I'm being culturally appropriative, then what does it matter if I'm actually being culturally appropriative or not? As an adult, I don't speak Mandarin anymore. I'm too old to wave a lantern around. I rarely visit Hong Kong. And honestly, I hate it. I hate that I've let the world decide who I get to be because of how I look. I hate being afraid of taking part in things that felt everyday and ordinary when I was a kid. My mom worked so hard to make sure I was proud of where I came from, and I am proud. But my pride is quieter now. It's like I'm hiding something all the time, not out of shame, but out of fear. That cheongsam now collects dust in my closet at my mom's house. Sometimes when I visit, I'll dig around and I'll see it shoved in the back. I'll remember the last time I wore it, how pretty I felt, how proud I was allowed to be.
And I'll remember how easily that was all taken away. How this symbol of my identity, this badge of honor, has now become a symbol of fear. Cultural appropriation, as important as it is to call it out when you see it, isn't as cut and dry as it's made out to be. And in order to protect a part of my identity that I still value so much, in order to protect the little girl who kept her red packet money in a Hello Kitty wallet under the bed, well, in the back of the closet, that Chung Sam will have to stay. At least for now.
Thanks, Gina, for sharing your story with us. Gina May is a writer based in Los Angeles. And that wraps it up for our first take, but probably not our last, on the issue of cultural appropriation. And by the way, Feliz Día de los Muertos!
That's it for today. This episode of Latino USA was produced by Zakia Gibbons, Marlon Bishop, Fernanda Chavarri, Andres Caballero, Antonia Cerejido, Julia Shu, Noam Hassenfeld, and Maggie Freeling. Our senior editor is Nadia Raymond. Additional engineering help this week from Stephanie LeBeau. Our engineer and music editor is Cornelius McMoyler. Our production manager is Natalia Fiedelholz. Our interns are Mallory Shingle and Liz Tung. And we had help this week from Robert Frazier. And we want to remind you to help us out by taking the Latino USA survey. It's anonymous. You can tell us what you love, what you want us to do better, and it'll only take you a couple of minutes. You'll be doing us a big favor by filling it out. Show us some love by going to npr.org/Latino USA survey. And that's all one word. Gracias. And if you enjoyed the music that you heard on this episode and you want to learn more, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and on Instagram. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by Unbound Philanthropy, ensuring that migrants and refugees are valued, treated with respect, and are able to build relationships of mutual engagement with their new communities. And the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.
Ask me what he said.
So what did he say in the article? I like that.
Ask me. I don't know why I whispered.
Ask me what he said. Ask me now. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA.
You know, Grandpa used to go up to the gate every time we passed that darn gate, and he would spit on the floor, and he would give them the bird.
The complicated relationship between Dodger Stadium and a Mexican-American community in the 1950s. That's next time on Latino USA.